Welcome to The Deep Dive. I'm Chris Anderson.
And I'm Lee Bradley. Today, we are undertaking a comprehensive deep dive into the Associated Press Evening Edition for Sunday, September 21st, 2025.
That's right. And for you, our mission is, well, to give you the critical context, the essential insights, help you get your head around this massive stack of global reports fast.
Yeah, there's a lot here. We're covering everything from, you know, active conflicts and some pretty chilling political moves here in the U.S., all the way to big ethical questions about technology, and even, believe it or not, shifts in health policy and environmental science that might surprise you.
It's a huge snapshot of where we are right now.
Exactly. And our goal isn't just to summarize. We want to pull out the underlying connections, the implications, show you how things like global security tensions, politics at home, and even stuff like your choice of pet. How it's all sort of interconnected.
And what it all means today. Okay, let's get straight into it. Some really pressing security concerns first.
Yeah, definitely. Let's start in Eastern Europe. There's been a really serious escalation between NATO and Russia, specifically a major airspace violation over Estonia.
Not just a minor blip on the radar, then.
Oh, absolutely not. This was significant. We're talking Russian jets, looks like two Su-35s, deliberately flying into Estonian airspace over the Gulf of Finland.
And the location matters, right? That route.
Hugely. They were flying from Petrozavodsk, that's in Western Russia, towards Kaliningrad. That's the heavily militarized Russian territory wedged between Poland and Lithuania. It's a route that demands real precision. You don't just wander off course there.
So NATO jets responded.
They did. Italian F-35s, part of NATO's Baltic Air Policing Mission, they intercepted, tried everything, according to Estonian officials. Visual signals, radio calls.
And the Russian pilots?
Just ignored them. Completely ignored them. Flew on through for several minutes.
Now, Russia's denying it, I assume.
Of course. The Russian Defense Ministry put out a statement pretty quickly. Claimed their jets stayed in neutral waters, you know, more than 3 kilometers from the nearest Estonian island, Vainluu Island.
But Estonia says otherwise.
Adamantly. They're citing multiple radar tracks confirming the violation, and crucially, visual confirmation from the Italian pilots themselves.
So multiple sources saying, yes, this absolutely happened. Mm. Deliberately.
That's the picture being painted. Calculated risk, not some navigation error.
And the political reaction.
Immediate and serious. Estonia's foreign minister called it a very serious violation of sovereignty. Straight up.
Yeah.
And they've confirmed they plan to request consultations under NATO's Article 4.
Okay, remind us Article 4. That's the our security is threatened, let's talk clause, right? Not Article 5. The attack on one is an attack on all.
Exactly right. Invoking Article 4 shows extreme concern. It brings the issue formally to the entire NATO alliance for discussion, but it doesn't automatically trigger that collective military response of Article 5. It's a serious step, but one short of the ultimate trigger.
And other NATO allies are weighing in.
Oh, yes. The Czech president, Peter Pavel, he's a former senior NATO military commander, so his words carry weight. It was quite stark. He said NATO needs to respond adequately to these kinds of provocations. Warned the whole situation is, quote, teetering on the edge of conflict.
Wow. Did he suggest what an adequate response might look like?
He actually floated the idea that in some circumstances, if warnings are ignored, an adequate response could even include shooting down violating aircraft.
Shooting them down. That's escalatory.
Extremely. Though he did stress later it should be an absolute last resort, but just mentioning it shows how high the tensions are running.
So what's the thinking behind why Russia might be doing this now?
Well, the analysis coming from Estonian officials is fascinating. They think it's part of a broader pattern. They suggest Russia is using these kinds of air violations, plus ongoing hybrid warfare tactics, cyber attacks, basically anything to distract the West.
Distract from Ukraine.
Precisely. The theory is if they can provoke NATO, make the alliance nervous about its own borders, maybe NATO will have to divert some of its high-end air defense assets.
Like Patriot missile systems or maybe more fighter jets.
Exactly. Divert those away from supporting Kyiv and instead use them to bolster NATO's own eastern flank defenses.
So it's a strategic move to try and weaken support for Ukraine by creating problems elsewhere. Classic diversion.
It looks very much like that. A calculated move of operational distraction to gain leverage in the main theater.
That theme of disruption, It links directly to another major incident this weekend, doesn't it? This big supply chain cyber attack.
It really does. And this one hit closer to home for a lot of travelers, exposing a huge vulnerability in the global aviation system.
What happened exactly?
Okay, so Friday night, A pretty sophisticated cyber attack hit the check-in and boarding systems at several major European airports. We're talking Brussels, Berlin, London, Heathrow.
What system specifically?
It was the MUSE software. Now, here's the critical part. The attackers didn't hit the airlines directly. They didn't breach the airport networks themselves.
So where did they hit?
They went after a third-party provider, a company called Collins Aerospace. They provide these shared digital systems that many airlines and airports rely on for check-in and boarding.
Ah, so single point of failure. Hit one vendor, affect potentially dozens of airlines and airports.
Exactly. That's the vulnerability. And the impact was instant, and it crossed borders.
How bad was it?
Well, Brussels Airport reported 9 flights outright canceled. Dozens more delayed. They had to scramble and revert to manual check-in procedures. You can imagine the lines, the chaos.
Total nightmare for passengers. And it highlights how dependent we are on these interconnected, often outsourced digital systems.
Hugely dependent. Compromise one key vendor, and you can cause widespread disruption almost instantly. It's what keeps security analysts up at night when they think about critical infrastructure.
Was it ransomware? Were they demanding money?
That's the interesting and perhaps more worrying part. An analyst, James Davenport, looking at the initial details, made a pretty chilling observation. He said it, quote, looks almost more like vandalism than extortion.
Vandalism, meaning the goal wasn't money, just chaos. Disruption for disruption's sake.
That seems to be the implication, based on what we know so far. If they're not asking for a ransom to restore the systems, it changes everything. You can't negotiate your way out of it. The goal might just be to cause maximum disruption or maybe to demonstrate a capability to show they can do this.
Which makes defense much harder. You're not trying to prevent data theft or extortion. You're trying to defend against pure disruption.
Exactly. It shifts the focus entirely to system resilience, backups, and how fast you can recover physically, like going back to manual check-ins.
And it raises the question, who would do this? If not for money, then who benefits from just sowing chaos in global travel? That's unsettling.
Yeah, deeply unsettling. While those technical fires were burning, the AP reports also brought us back to the grim realities of ongoing human conflicts around the world, starting with Ukraine.
The focus was on Mariupol, wasn't it? A really harrowing account.
Yes, just heartbreaking. Documenting the continued despair there, but also looking back with specific verified details from the siege that started way back in March 2022. The reports confirm the brutal facts on the ground. Civilians buried in hastily dug mass graves. Documented deaths of children.
Specific names were mentioned, I recall.
Tragically, yes. Like 18-month-old Kirill, killed by shrapnel, and 16-year-old Ilya, whose legs were blown off while he was just playing soccer near the fighting. These aren't abstract numbers. These details really underscore the sheer brutality of the siege tactics, used starvation, indiscriminate violence, the deliberate destruction of places people needed to survive.
The reports also addressed the bombing of the maternity hospital, didn't they? Countering some of the Russian narratives.
They did, and it's crucial. AP reporters who were there, who documented the immediate aftermath, confirmed that Russian officials actually used the bombed hospital as a base after the attack. And critically, these reporters verified there was absolutely no evidence suggesting the hospital was being used for military purposes before the bombing, directly refuting the Russian claims that it was somehow a legitimate target or had been emptied of patients.
So, vital eyewitness accounts for the historical record, for accountability down the line.
Absolutely essential. Now, shifting focus to the Middle East, the conflict in Gaza also continues with high intensity.
More casualties reported.
Yes, sadly. The reports confirmed at least 14 more deaths in the latest Israeli offensive operations, and that included 6 members of the family of a director at Shifa Hospital.
At the same time, there's growing pressure inside Israel, isn't there, regarding the hostages?
Very much so. The families of the Israeli hostages held in Gaza are continuing their protests, very visible, very emotional. They're demanding Prime Minister Netanyahu prioritize negotiations to end the war and secure the release of their loved ones.
And some are accusing him of dragging his feet.
Some protesters are going further, yes, alleging that Netanyahu might be prolonging the conflict for his own political survival to avoid facing potential accountability once the fighting stops. That's creating real fractures in Israeli society about the war's aims and endgame.
Okay, let's move across the Atlantic now. Latin America seems to be a hot spot of tensions, too. Venezuela first.
Right. The sources detailed a U.S. military operation off the Venezuelan coast. an attack on a boat that was allegedly carrying drugs and gang members.
And the fallout.
Immediate spike in local tensions. It particularly affected nearby fishing communities, understandably worried. And in response, the Venezuelan military made a very public show of force, with troops seen touring the capital, Caracas. A clear signal of readiness amidst these ongoing, very high tensions with the United States.
Then there's Haiti, still facing that immense gang crisis.
Immense is the right word. Haitian soldiers, who just got back from intensive military training in Mexico, are now home, and they face this incredibly daunting task, trying to take back control from the gangs. These gangs now control something like 90% of the capital, Port-au-Prince.
This is all still fallout from the president's assassination back in 2021.
Largely, yes. The assassination of President Moïse left a power vacuum, politically and in terms of security, that the gangs just flooded into. These newly trained soldiers are desperately needed, but it's an uphill battle.
And finally, in this region, Argentina. President Milei is facing trouble.
Big trouble, yeah. A major political and economic crisis seems to be brewing there.
What happened?
His government suffered a really significant electoral defeat in a key region, Buenos Aires province, and the market reaction was immediate and brutal. Fear kicked in, the peso's value dropped sharply, and government bonds collapsed.
So investors are losing confidence. Why now?
It seems Milei's radical shock therapy approach to fixing the economy, focusing almost entirely on crushing inflation through drastic budget cuts and deregulation, well, it's hitting a wall.
The political cost is getting too high.
That's what the analysis suggests. The economic pain cuts to services. Rising unemployment seems to have become unbearable for enough voters, leading to this electoral defeat. And the market reaction shows that investor confidence isn't just about inflation numbers. It's tied directly to whether they think Milei's reforms are politically sustainable. Right now, that looks very shaky.
Wow. Okay, that global picture sets the stage for what's happening right here in the U.S. political arena, which seems just as fraught with conflict, control, and closures.
Yeah, closures, right, with a potential government shutdown looming. But let's start with a really controversial move involving executive power and the justice system.
This is the judicial nomination.
Exactly. President Trump nominated Lindsay Halligan, who's currently a senior White House aide, to be the top federal prosecutor, the U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of Virginia.
Okay, why is that specific office so important?
Because the Eastern District of Virginia, or EDVA as it's known, is the office currently handling the investigation into New York Attorney General Letitia James.
Letitia James, yeah. A major political opponent of Trump.
A very vocal, longtime opponent, yes.
Yeah.
And the timing here is, well, let's just say it's raising eyebrows.
How so?
Halligan's nomination comes right after the previous U.S. attorney for that office, Eric Siebert, resigned. And sources are indicating Siebert stepped down because he was feeling pressure from within the administration to speed up the process, essentially to bring charges against James more quickly.
And Halligan isn't just some random aide, right? She has a history with Trump.
A very direct history. She previously served as one of Trump's personal lawyers, including during the early, very sensitive stages of that Mar-a-Lago classified documents investigation.
So, appointing his former personal lawyer to oversee an investigation into a key political rival.
It's being widely seen by critics as a pretty blatant step towards fulfilling Trump's public vow for retribution against people he sees as his political enemies.
This feels like more than just politics as usual.
It certainly pushes the boundaries, and it's happening alongside Trump, publicly demanding that his attorney general, Pam Bondi, act fast on these investigations. He literally said they need to determine quickly if targets like James or even former FBI Director James Comey are guilty or not guilty.
Putting his thumb on the scales of justice, critics would say.
That's exactly the concern. Placing a political loyalist, a former personal lawyer, into such a sensitive prosecutorial role, it raises fundamental questions about the independence of the Justice Department. Are they pursuing justice or are they pursuing political vendettas? The lines get very blurry very fast.
Okay, while that's unfolding, we also have this ticking clock towards a government shutdown. September 30th is the deadline.
That's right. The deadline is looming, and the government is not funded beyond that date. We're seeing Democratic leaders, Senator Schumer in the Senate, Representative Jeffries in the House, publicly demanding a meeting with Trump. They want to negotiate a deal to keep the government open.
What's the main sticking point in these negotiations?
It really boils down to healthcare programs. It's a major legislative fight.
Okay, what specifically?
Democrats are pushing hard to keep the enhanced health insurance subsidies going. These are the subsidies under the Affordable Care Act, the ACA, that help millions of people afford their insurance premiums. And critically, they also want to reverse some deep cuts to Medicaid that were baked into a previous spending bill passed by Republicans.
And Republicans are saying no to reversing the Medicaid cuts.
That seems to be the line in the sand for them. They're refusing to undo those Medicaid changes, and that's created this impasse.
So Congress hasn't passed any funding bills, either Republican or Democratic versions?
Nope, neither side could get their version through, which makes a shutdown look increasingly likely.
Trump himself even mentioned the possibility of a closed country for a period of time.
He did use that phrase. Now, we should clarify for you what that actually means in practice. Essential services generally continue, so the military still gets paid, Social Security checks still go out.
But non-essential stuff stops.
Right. Hundreds of thousands of federal workers get furloughed, sent home without pay. National parks might close gates, passport processing could slow down, lots of government functions just stop.
And the fight being specifically over Medicaid cuts means the impact of this potential shutdown could hit vulnerable people particularly hard.
That's a major concern, yes. When essential health funding is part of the political battle, the consequences can be severe for those who rely on those programs.
This level of political conflict seems to be reflected in how policies are being enforced on the ground, too, especially immigration. This Operation Midway Blitz in Chicago.
Yeah, that's a significant development. ICE Immigration and Customs Enforcement launched this big operation in Chicago. And Chicago is notable because it's a city with strong sanctuary city laws, meaning local police are generally prohibited from cooperating with federal immigration agents.
So ICE went in anyway, without local help.
They did. And in less than 2 weeks, they arrested nearly 550 people. It was a major show of federal force in a city that actively resists cooperation.
And there's controversy around how it was carried out. Use of force.
Yes, significant controversy. The acting head of ICE, Marcos Charles, had to publicly address criticisms. He denied excessive force was used overall, but he did claim they're seeing an uptick in people that are not compliant.
And he blamed that noncompliance on activists.
Directly. He blamed activist rhetoric for encouraging people to resist arrest.
What are the activists saying?
They're pushing back hard, accusing ICE of deliberately escalating encounters, provoking people, essentially manufacturing situations to justify using harsher tactics. Their line is blunt. ICE does not belong here.
And there was a fatal shooting during this operation.
Tragically, yes. A man named Silverio Villegas Gonzalez was shot and killed by ICE officers. The official account is that he allegedly drove his car towards the officers. But this incident is right at the center of the dispute. It highlights just how dangerous and volatile these encounters have become, with completely conflicting narratives about what happened. There are calls for a full, transparent investigation into that use of deadly force.
This intense federal action prompted pushback in California, right? With new laws.
Immediate and direct pushback. Governor Gavin Newsom signed a bill specifically targeting the way federal agents operate. It actually bans most law enforcement officers, including federal immigration agents, from wearing masks or other face coverings during raids or arrests.
Why masks specifically?
It was a direct response to recent incidents where federal agents wearing masks that obscured their identities conducted large-scale raids. Critics argued the masks made it impossible for local officials or the public to identify the agents involved, hindering accountability.
How did the federal government react to that?
Predictably, with immediate condemnation. It instantly set up this clash over jurisdiction. Federal officials, like Republican Assemblyman Asele, basically said California has zero authority to tell federal agents how to conduct their operations. They stated flatly that agents will continue wearing masks if they deem it necessary for safety.
What was their safety justification?
They claimed agents face risks of being doxxed, having their personal information exposed online, and then potentially targeted by, quote, known and suspected terrorist sympathizers.
And Newsom's response to that claim?
He dismissed it, called the doxing concerns unfounded and unproven, and doubled down on the state's right to demand transparency from any law enforcement operating within its borders.
And Newsom signed another law, too.
Yes, the California Safe Haven Schools Act. This one adds another layer of restriction, preventing immigration agents from entering school grounds or healthcare facilities unless they have a specific judicial warrant.
So California's really digging in, using state law to actively resist federal immigration enforcement tactics, a major state versus federal conflict.
Absolutely. It's a deep, ongoing institutional battle over who controls immigration enforcement and how it's carried out.
Okay, shifting from enforcement to data and policy. The administration is ending a major government report, the one on food security.
That's right. A pretty significant policy change with potentially broad implications. The Trump administration announced it's stopping the publication of the annual Household Food Security Report.
This is a long-running report, isn't it? It tracks hunger and food access.
Yes, it's been a key benchmark for decades. The administration's official reason for ending it, they claim the data is overly politicized and rife with inaccuracies. They argue it creates a false negative narrative about how food-secure Americans actually are.
But critics see it differently, as trying to hide bad news.
That's exactly the criticism. Groups like the Center for American Progress immediately condemned it. They accuse the administration of using a playbook of many non-democracies. Basically, if you don't like the data a government report might show, you just stop collecting or publishing the report.
And the timing is notable, coming after cuts to food assistance programs.
Very notable. This decision comes right after the administration implemented significant cuts to the SNAP program, what most people know as food stamps. Those cuts are estimated to affect around 3 million people.
So cut the benefits, then stop measuring if more people are going hungry. The optics aren't great.
The optics are challenging, yes. The critique is simple. It looks like an attempt to eliminate the evidence of a potential problem rather than addressing the problem itself.
Okay, and finally, in this U.S. policy section, this huge controversial change to H-1B visas, the $100,000 fee.
Yeah, this one sent shockwaves through the tech industry and globally. A new extremely high fee of $100,000 for applying for an H-1B visa.
H-1Bs being the main visa for high-skilled foreign workers, right?
Mm-hmm.
Especially in tech.
That's correct. Now, this fee only applies to new applicants, not people who already have an H-1B or are renewing one. But there was some initial chaos and confusion around that.
How so?
Well, apparently, Commerce Secretary Lutnick initially suggested it might be an annual fee.
An annual $100,000 cost. Per employee.
Can you imagine? The White House had to scramble very quickly to issue a clarification. No, it's a one-time fee per initial application.
Okay, one time is better than annual, but still.
Yeah.
Compared to the old fee.
It's astronomical. The previous application fee was only about $215. So jumping from $215 to $100,000 is just staggering.
What's the intended effect? Or the likely effect?
The likely effect is a drastic reduction in the number of companies willing or able to sponsor workers for H-1B visas. Critics are calling it ludicrously lawless, basically designed to kill the program by making it prohibitively expensive.
Fan service for immigration restrictionists was one quote I saw.
That sums up the criticism. And countries like India, which supply something like 70% of all H-1B holders, are expressing really deep concern, not just about the economic disruption, but the humanitarian side for skilled workers whose plans are now completely upended.
And legal challenges are expected.
Almost certain. Trying to impose such a massive fee via executive action without clear authorization from Congress is legally very questionable. This policy seems destined for the courts, but in the meantime, it's causing huge anxiety and disruption.
Before we move on to the media landscape, there was also a significant piece in the sources about a major legal drama unfolding elsewhere inside the Vatican.
Yes, absolutely. Often called the Vatican's trial of the century. It's now heading into a really crucial appeals phase.
This involves that big London property deal that went bad. And Cardinal Becciu?
That's the one. A disastrous 350 million euro investment in a luxury London building. Cardinal Becciu was the highest profile figure convicted in the initial trial and sentenced. But the appeal could potentially overturn everything based on some pretty explosive near evidence that's come to light.
What kind of evidence?
Thousands of pages of private WhatsApp messages and audio recordings, text between key figures involved in the investigation itself.
And what did these messages show?
They seem to lay bare some intense, potentially manipulative behind-the-scenes maneuvering. Specifically, how figures like a PR specialist named Francesca Schauke and a family friend apparently worked really hard to persuade a key suspect, Monsignor Alberto Balasca, to basically flip, become a state witness, and testify against Cardinal Becciu.
So the defense is arguing the testimony was tainted from the start.
That's exactly their argument, that these messages show improper pressure and manipulation that contaminated the whole evidence-gathering process.
And the Pope himself is involved in this.
That's what makes the appeal potentially so explosive. The texts apparently reveal Pope Francis was more directly involved than previously known. We already knew from the first trial that the Pope had issued some secret decrees that helped the prosecutors, giving them special powers and bypassing some normal procedures.
But the texts show more.
They seem to show Francis was personally quite close to the investigation, allegedly encouraging Perlasca right before he was questioned, and, maybe most surprisingly, even lending Perlasca money after his Vatican bank accounts were frozen as part of the probe.
Wow. Lending money to a key witness.
It raises serious questions, and Becciu's defense lawyers are seizing on all of this. Their core argument now on appeal is that the Pope's actions, his direct encouragement, the financial support, the procedural shortcuts he allowed, fundamentally destroyed the separation of powers needed for a fair trial within the Vatican system.
They're saying the Pope acted as both executive and effectively interfered with the judiciary.
Precisely. That this blurring of roles makes the original conviction illegitimate. It's an unprecedented kind of constitutional challenge within the Holy See's legal structure, a really high stakes appeal to watch.
Okay, that's quite the detour into Vatican intrigue. Now, back to the U.S. and the intersection of media, free speech, and this digital disruption we keep seeing. The Charlie Kirk killing seems to be a focal point.
Absolutely. It's become this intense case study in how digital media shapes everything. Now, politics, grief, public discourse.
His memorial service is today, right? At that huge stadium in Arizona.
Yes, State Farm Stadium. And the reporting emphasizes how Kirk's rise was so tied to his mastery of social media. But the aftermath of his death has taken that to a whole new, frankly, unsettling level.
This is the AI-generated content.
Exactly. A huge surge of it. What people are starting to call digital grief.
What form does it take?
The sources documented AI-generated audio clips of Kirk's voice, delivering messages from beyond the grave, essentially. Things like, your work is done, come rest. And these clips were actually played in large evangelical churches like Dream City Church in Arizona.
Played in church?
Yeah.
And people applauded.
Apparently so.
Yeah.
Generated real emotional responses. It shows this entirely new way technology is intersecting with mourning and religion.
And it's not just audio, right? They're images, too.
Yeah. AI-generated images are flooding social media. Some are overtly religious, showing Kirk with Jesus, or in heaven taking selfies with figures like Lincoln and Martin Luther King Jr.
That's quite a juxtaposition.
It is. Other AI creations are more political, linking his death to conservative causes he championed, like an image showing him comforting Irina Zarutska, the Ukrainian refugee whose stabbing death Kirk had highlighted.
So it's this instant synthetic creation of meaning and legacy around his death, using AI.
Exactly. A rapid, technologically enabled shaping of public memory and grief raises huge questions about authenticity, manipulation, and where this all leads.
This whole environment prompted some strong reactions, didn't it?
Yeah.
Utah's governor.
Yeah, Governor Spencer Cox. He didn't mince words. He publicly called social media cancer, accused the tech companies of deliberately hacking brains, getting people addicted to outrage because it drives engagement and profit. He sees the platforms themselves as fostering the division and anger.
And the killing also intensified efforts to police online speech.
Dramatically. There is a fierce backlash against anyone online expressing negative views about Kirk after his death. It went beyond just criticism. We saw figures like Florida Representative Randy Fine publicly calling for government workers or licensed professionals who made negative posts to be identified and potentially punished. He actually said, congratulations, they got one, referring to Kirk's death.
Using a tragedy to demand conformity online.
That's certainly how critics are framing it, a move to leverage public emotion to chill dissenting speech.
And this environment kind of sets the stage for the Jimmy Kimmel suspension.
It absolutely provides the context. ABC indefinitely suspended Jimmy Kimmel from his late night show.
Why? What did he say?
It was due to comments he made about the Republican response to the Kirk killing. We don't have the exact quotes in these sources, but it was clearly deemed controversial enough by the network.
And this wasn't just a network decision in a vacuum. There was political pressure.
Intense and very public pressure. The FCC chairman, Brendan Carr, made a statement that sounded very much like a threat right before the suspension. He said, regarding the network, we can do this the easy way or the hard way. Soon after, Kimmel was off the air indefinitely.
Putting a mainstream comedian right in the crosshairs of a free speech fight?
Exactly. And the reaction from other comedians was immediate and strong.
What did they say?
People like Mark Maron didn't frame it as just a business decision by ABC. He called it what authoritarianism looks like. And the Egyptian satirist, Bassem Youssef, who famously lost his own show in Egypt after a military coup, drew a direct parallel. He said targeting comedians is often one of the first moves when democratic norms start to erode.
The reports drew parallels to other historical moments, too.
Yes, providing important context, reminding us of George Carlin's battles over obscenity, the cancellation of that popular satirical puppet show in Russia, Kukli, soon after Putin came to power, and more recent crackdowns on comedians in places like India and Iran.
So, seeing this Kimmel situation as part of a global pattern of pressure on satire and comedy when political tensions rise.
That's the perspective offered, yes. That comedy often becomes a canary in the coal mine for free expression.
And there was some irony pointed out regarding cancel culture.
Yes, Roseanne Barr weighed in. She pointed out this seeming hypocrisy, recalling how ABC canceled her own show back in 2018 for a racist tweet. She noted that some comedians now defending Kimmel as anti-woke champions of free speech were silent or even supportive when she was canceled.
So, highlighting how the definition of acceptable speech can shift depending on who is speaking and the current political winds.
Precisely. It underscores how messy and often inconsistent these debates about free speech and consequences can be.
Another huge player in this digital disruption space is TikTok. What's the latest there? Still banned? Or?
It's complicated. The Supreme Court did uphold the federal law that requires TikTok's parent company, ByteDance, which is based in China, to sell its U.S. operations or face a ban.
So the law stands. But the app is still working. It went dark briefly.
It did go dark temporarily, causing panic among its huge user base. But then services were restored.
Why?
Because President Trump issued an executive order giving ByteDance extra time to find a buyer.
Even though the law passed by Congress set a deadline, can he just do that?
Legally, it's very questionable whether he has the authority to unilaterally extend a deadline set by statute, but he did it anyway.
Why would he do that? He used to be against TikTok.
He's openly said he has a warm spot for TikTok now. He credits the platform with helping him gain popularity among younger voters, so his actions look politically motivated despite the bipartisan consensus in Congress about the national security risk.
And the core problem for any sale is still the algorithm, right?
That remains the absolute sticking point. The algorithm is TikTok's secret sauce, the code that makes the feed so addictive and personalized for its 170 million American users.
Has China agreed to let a potential buyer use the algorithm?
Apparently, China has indicated that a divested TikTok under new ownership could potentially still use the existing algorithm.
But U.S. officials are still worried, even if a U.S. company owns it.
Deeply worried. Their concern is that even with U.S. ownership, if the core algorithm is still linked to or shared with ByteDance in China, it remains vulnerable. Beijing could potentially still manipulate the algorithm, subtly promote certain narratives, suppress others, target specific groups without anyone knowing. It's a backdoor for foreign influence, they fear.
So the House Select Committee on China is saying any deal that involves sharing the algorithm isn't good enough.
Essentially, yes. They argue it wouldn't comply with the spirit of the law, which was intended to sever that potential link to Chinese influence completely. So the future of TikTok in the U.S. remains very much up in the air.
Okay, let's shift focus now. Away from the digital world and towards health, environment, and how we live our lives. Seems like we're often getting things wrong there, too.
That seems to be a running theme, yes. Especially when it comes to understanding our environmental impact.
This is the study about miscalculating carbon footprints.
Exactly. A study in PNAS Nexus found that Americans are consistently and often wildly inaccurate in judging the climate impact of their personal choices.
How so? What do we get wrong?
We tend to dramatically overestimate the positive impact of actions that are visible and feel good, but are actually low impact. Think things like meticulously recycling plastic or switching to energy efficient light bulbs.
You think those make a bigger difference than they do?
Much bigger, according to the study. And conversely, we drastically underestimate the impact of the really big ticket items.
Like what?
Like flying, like choosing renewable sources for your electricity. And this one might surprise you. Owning a dog.
Owning a dog. How is owning a dog a high-impact climate choice?
It comes down to what dogs eat. Most dogs are significant meat eaters. And meat production, especially beef and lamb, is a huge source of greenhouse gases, particularly methane, which is very potent in the short term.
So it's the carbon footprint of feeding the dog?
Primarily, yes. The study even made a striking comparison. You could adopt 100 rabbits who are herbivores, and their collective carbon footprint over a year still wouldn't match the emissions associated with feeding just one medium-sized meat-eating dog for that same year.
Wow. That really reframes things. It's about the hidden impacts.
Exactly. We focus on the visible act, like putting a bottle in the recycling bin, because it makes us feel like we're doing something. But the study showed, for example, that skipping just one round-trip flight between New York and Los Angeles saves about the same amount of carbon as giving up all meat for an entire year.
Or living without a car for months.
Right. Or living car-free for over 3 months. The scale of these high-impact choices just dwarfs the things we tend to focus on day to day.
So the solution is better information, helping people understand where the real impact lies.
That's what the experts suggest. More accessible, clear information could help people shift their focus towards making fewer but much more impactful commitments if they want to reduce their footprint.
Okay, sticking with environment and tech, electric tractors. Is that becoming a real thing in farming?
It's definitely being explored with some potential, but also some significant limitations right now.
Where do they see the potential?
Mostly for smaller farms, particularly those growing specialty crops, things like asparagus, carrots, maybe vineyards, crops where you don't need the absolute maximum horsepower.
What are the benefits for those farmers?
Reduced noise is a big one. Zero emissions right there on the farm, which is good for air quality. And potentially big cost savings if the farmer can charge the tractor using on-site renewable energy, like solar panels. Then your fuel costs drop dramatically.
But they're not ready for prime time on big farms, like corn and soybean operations.
Not yet, generally speaking. The main hurdles are battery life. Current models struggle to last a full day of heavy work and raw power. They just can't match the massive horsepower of the giant diesel tractors needed for plowing or harvesting thousands of acres efficiently.
Is there a connection to automation?
Yes. Electric power is seen as a key enabler for more automation. Quieter, potentially more precise control systems could allow the operator to focus less on just steering and more on monitoring the quality of the planting or weeding or harvesting being done by the machine itself, though some argue diesel could power automated tractors just as well.
Interesting. Okay, let's turn to public health. There was a major shift in COVID vaccine guidance.
Yes, a really significant change coming from the vaccine advisory panel handpicked by the current health secretary, Robert F. Kennedy Jr.
What did they decide?
They voted to change the official guidance for COVID shots. They specifically declined to recommend them across the board, even for groups traditionally considered high risk, like seniors or people with chronic health conditions.
So no general recommendation anymore. What's the guidance then?
They framed it as an individual choice, saying people should discuss it with their doctor and decide for themselves. This is a major departure from previous CDC guidance, which recommended annual shots for almost everyone.
That seems likely to cause confusion, doesn't it? Especially for vulnerable people looking for clear advice.
That's the big concern, yes. Public health relies on clear, consistent messaging. This shift towards ambiguity risks confusing people.
Does it affect insurance coverage? Will people have to pay?
HHS, the Department of Health and Human Services, put out a statement quickly saying that the vote structure still allows for coverage through all the usual mechanisms. Major insurers have also said they plan to keep covering the shots at no cost to patients, at least through 2026.
So access should remain, but the official recommendation is much weaker, reflecting the secretary's known skepticism.
It certainly aligns with Secretary Kennedy's longstanding efforts to challenge established vaccine policies and question data from agencies like the CDC. It's part of a broader reshaping of public health messaging under his leadership.
Okay, one more health-related item. Artificial dyes in ice cream.
Yes, a move that seems positive on the surface. U.S. ice cream manufacturers, apparently representing about 90% of the market, have pledged to stop using common artificial dyes.
Which dyes are we talking about?
Things like red 3, red 40, yellow 5, yellow 6, those common synthetic colorings. They've committed to phasing them out by 2028. This follows a push from the Trump administration on food additives.
Seems like a win for people concerned about artificial ingredients.
It is being celebrated as such. However, critics immediately pointed out a potential issue.
Which is?
That focusing just on the dyes might distract from the bigger health concerns with ice cream, namely the really high amounts of added sugars and saturated fat.
It's like focusing on the paint job while ignoring the engine problems.
That's the analogy, yeah. Is removing Red 40 the most important health improvement needed for ice cream? Probably not, compared to sugar content. And adding another layer of complexity, the FDA commissioner, Dr. Makary, hinted that upcoming federal dietary guidelines might actually start questioning the long-held link between saturated fat and heart disease.
Really? challenging that link.
That's what he hinted at. So the whole nutritional landscape around fats and sugars might be in flux, making the focus solely on diets seem potentially narrow.
Okay, let's move into our final section, wellness, culture, and some of the quirkier things happening, starting with mental fitness and coping strategies.
Right. The sources highlighted cognitive behavior therapy, CBT, as a really practical tool, especially for tackling negative thought spirals, like feeling you're an imposter.
How does CBT work in that case?
It's about identifying those automatic negative thoughts like, I am going to fail this presentation or I don't deserve this job, and then actively challenging them, asking yourself, is this thought really accurate? What's the evidence?
And then replacing the negative thought.
Exactly. Replacing it with a more realistic, balanced, or positive thought based on actual evidence. Like, I've prepared well for this presentation, or I was hired because I have the skills. It's about retraining your thought patterns.
Some similar things help too, right? Like just breathing.
Absolutely. The Working Well segment really emphasized this. Simple deep breathing techniques, they mention box breathing, or alternate nostril breathing can make a quick, noticeable difference. Doing them even for a minute or two at your desk can lower stress, reduce anxiety, even help lower blood pressure, a really accessible tool to feel more grounded during a hectic workday.
There was also a piece about finding analog alternatives to screens.
Yeah.
People getting overwhelmed by screen time.
Yes, a definite trend. The source mentioned one woman who realized she was spending over 12 hours a day looking at screens, phone, computer, TV, just constant digital input.
And she found relief in fountain pens.
Apparently so. Journaling with nice fountain pens and different colored inks became her screen-free outlet. But the broader point wasn't about pens specifically. It was advice not to pressure yourself to find one single perfect life-changing hobby. Instead, try to find a mix of small, enjoyable, non-digital activities you can sprinkle throughout your day or week.
Like quick resets. Doesn't have to be a huge commitment.
Exactly. Little moments of tactile, non-screen engagement can apparently do wonders for mood and mental health without the stress of trying to become, you know, a master potter overnight.
Good advice. What about mindful eating? Something about eating too fast.
Yes, strong advice against eating meals in 20 minutes or less.
Why is eating fast bad, other than maybe indigestion?
It's about brain signals. Your brain takes time, roughly 20 minutes, to register feelings of fullness or satiety. If you wolf down your food in 10 minutes, you can easily eat way more than you need before your brain gets the I'm full message. Increases the risk of overeating.
So how to slow down?
Simple things. Put down your phone. Turn off the TV, focus on the food. Maybe try using your non-dominant hand to eat, which forces you to be more deliberate. Or just consciously take sips of water between bites. Anything to stretch out the mealtime.
And fear of flying is apparently increasing.
Reports suggest it is, possibly linked to recent high-profile aviation incidents getting a lot of media coverage. Aerophobia seems to be spiking.
How do experts suggest dealing with it? Not statistics, apparently.
Right. Experts say trying to reason with someone who has a phobia by quoting safety statistics is usually pointless. The fear isn't rational. Treatment focuses more on managing the physical anxiety response, like deep breathing, but specifically making the exhale longer than the inhale, which calms the nervous system, and then gradual exposure therapy.
Starting small.
Very small. Maybe just looking at pictures of airplanes, then watching videos, maybe visiting an airport. Eventually, perhaps using virtual reality, VR, to simulate being on a plane before trying a real flight. Slow, steady steps.
Okay, shifting to culture. Skincare advice. Seems dermatologists are pushing back against trends.
They really are. The message was clear. Social media has made skincare way overcomplicated.
Too many steps. Too many expensive products.
Exactly. Dermatologists are advising people to ignore a lot of the hype around trendy, often pricey ingredients, things like specialized beef tallow for your face or expensive snail mucin serums.
Their main point.
Price does not equal efficacy. You don't need a 10-step routine with $100 serums. A simple, consistent routine with basic, proven ingredients is usually best. Cleanse, moisturize, sunscreen.
What about things like those red light therapy masks?
They acknowledge red light might have some minor benefits for inflammation or collagen, but stress that you need to use them very frequently and consistently for a long time to see even subtle results. Often the cost and commitment don't justify the minimal return for most people. Keep it simple.
Fascinating. What about Ghana's fantasy coffins? That sounded unique.
Oh, incredibly unique and beautiful. They're called Abebuo coffins, which means proverb coffins. These are custom-made, brightly colored, often quite whimsical coffins designed to celebrate the life and identity of the person who died.
Like-shaped-like things.
Exactly. The article mentioned a fishmonger buried in a giant, colorful fish, a taxi driver buried in a coffin shaped like his car, a farmer in a giant chili pepper. The idea is to transform the funeral from just sorrow into a vibrant celebration of that person's legacy and passion, their amazing works of folk art, and gaining international recognition.
That's incredible. And San Francisco City Hall is now a hotspot for quinceañera photos.
Apparently so. The building's grand architecture, the marble staircase, the rotunda, has become a super popular, very elegant backdrop for quinceañera photo shoots.
And quinceañeras being the traditional coming-of-age celebration for 15-year-old Latina girls.
Correct. And social media seems to be driving this trend. Families want those really striking, memorable photos in a grand setting, and City Hall provides it.
Then there's a lawsuit against Bad Bunny over a house.
A rather unusual one, yes. An 84-year-old man in Puerto Rico is suing the music superstar for over $1 million. He claims that his unique, hand-built, salmon-colored house was used as the direct inspiration and model for a set piece in Bad Bunny's concerts, a replica house called La Casita.
And the problem is?
The man alleges that this unwanted fame for his house has led to constant harassment, people trespassing, a complete loss of privacy. He also claims he was tricked into signing release forms, making them invalid, so he's suing for damages.
Wow. And we also lost a music legend, Sonny Curtis.
Sadly, yes. Yeah. Sonny Curtis passed away at 88, a really influential figure. He was an early member of Buddy Holly's band, The Crickets. He wrote the rock and roll standard, I Fought the Law, made famous later by The Clash.
And he wrote a very famous TV theme song, too.
He did. The instantly recognizable theme for the Mary Tyler Moore show, Love Is All Around. A true legend with a diverse legacy.
Okay, let's wrap up with a few quirky odds and ends from the reports. Finland's Air Force and swastikas.
Yeah, a bit of historical baggage being dealt with. The Finnish Air Force has used a swastika symbol on some flags and emblems since way back in 1918. Importantly, it was adopted before the Nazis came to power in Germany and had a different origin. It came from a Swedish count who donated the first plane and who happened to be related by marriage to Hermann Göring. But the symbol itself wasn't initially Nazi-related for Finland.
But it looks bad now, obviously.
Exactly. So following Finland's integration into NATO, they're now actively phasing out the symbol from the remaining unit flags to align with modern sensitivities and avoid any misinterpretation.
Then we have a ground squirrel invasion.
In Minot, North Dakota, yes. Richardson's ground squirrels, apparently they are prolific tunnelers, described as ferocious, and their population has exploded to the point where officials worry the squirrels might actually outnumber the city's human residents.
Nothing damage.
Major damage. Burrowing under roads, foundations, disrupting infrastructure. Residents are alarmed, and the city is actively fighting back with traps and, reportedly, even air rifles. An unexpected urban wildlife battle.
And giant wooden trolls are saving the humans.
Metaphorically, yes. This is a cool art project by a Danish recycle artist named Thomas Dambo. He builds these huge, whimsical trolls out of reclaimed wood and hides them in natural settings around the world. The whole installation is called Trolls Save the Humans.
What's the message?
It's an environmental message delivered through folklore. The trolls are depicted as ancient guardians of nature, reminding us humans to protect the planet, recycle materials, and stop being so wasteful. A creative way to spread awareness.
Any sports notes? Caitlin Clark find.
Just a couple quick ones. WNBA star Caitlin Clark got a $200 fine for a social media post after a playoff win. She apparently wrote, "Refs couldn't stop us." A little jab that cost her.
And Liverpool FC news.
Yeah, apparently key players Isak and Wirtz were benched for the big Merseyside derby match against Everton, a significant team selection choice.
And finally, a whale encounter gone wrong.
A very close call off the coast of New Hampshire. A whale likely lunged feeding near the surface and probably unaware of the boat came up right underneath a 23-foot fishing boat.
Capsized it.
Violently capsized it, throwing the two fishermen into the water.
Were they okay?
Thankfully, yes. They were rescued very quickly by two young brothers who were in another boat nearby and saw it happen. True Good Samaritans in a sudden, very dangerous situation. Probably terrifying for everyone involved, including maybe the whale.
Wow. What a range of stories. This deep dive into the AP reports really covers the spectrum, doesn't it? From, high-stakes international incidents like airspace violations to really granular domestic policies like deportation tactics.
All the way to the ethics of Aya grief, the surprising climate impact of your dog, and even just the simple wisdom of remembering to breathe deeply. It's an overwhelming amount of information coming at us constantly.
So looking across all these different reports, is there a common thread you see?
I think the biggest one is the constant need for critical assessment, for really questioning the information we receive and the assumptions we make. Are we seeing the full picture when we hear about Russian maneuvers, or is it rhetoric designed to distract? Is AI-generated mourning genuine or manipulative? Are we really making impactful climate choices, or just the ones that feel good?
We're constantly navigating this landscape of potential miscalculation, manipulation, maybe even deliberate attempts to control the narrative.
Exactly. And the sources today really highlight that pattern. We seem to consistently misjudge the weight of things. We focus on the visible, the immediate, the easy action.
While maybe overlooking the bigger, harder, less visible challenges.
Precisely. So the final thought to leave you with today as you process all this is maybe to turn that lens on yourself. What low-impact action are you still prioritizing, mainly because it's visible, or it gives you that quick feeling of doing something maybe like that extra meticulous recycling?
And on the flip side, what potentially high-impact, maybe less visible issue are you overlooking? Perhaps it's the carbon footprint of your travel, or a challenging conversation you need to have at work about an unfair policy, or maybe just questioning a narrative you've accepted without really digging deeper.
What requires the harder commitment, the less immediate reward, but might actually make a bigger difference today? Something to think about.
Until next time, keep digging.